You're listening to the Locked In Podcast. Here's your host, Algernon Cash.
I'm Algernon Cash, and you're locked in. We are right in the middle of the 2022 midterm election cycle. Got a big primary that's coming up, mainly for the Republicans at the top of the ticket. On the Democratic side, they have already coalesced around their nominee, which is going to be former Justice Sherry Beasley is expected to be the nominee on the Democratic side. But on the Republican side, there is a big fight that's going on between former Governor Pat McCrory, as well as former Congressman Mark Walker, and current Congressman Ted Budd. There's a lot of other people in this race. Let me say that, by the way. There's probably 20 candidates in the race, but a lot of people talking about the top three candidates. So I wanted to invite my good friend John Hood, who is not only a conservative pundit, but also president of the John William Polk Foundation, author, and I'm sure you've read his op-eds in the Carolina Journal, amongst other places, to just come and share some commentary about what's going on right now inside of the Republican Party. John, thank you for locking in with me today. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. I'm anxious. I'm anxious to find out who's going to win this race. Now, of course, the polls tell us that we should be expecting a win out of the Budd camp. Polls have been wrong before. I know they're still in the latest poll I saw. There were still somewhere around 20% undecided Republicans. So things can certainly go one direction or the other. It does seem like Mark Walker at this point is out of the race, but it's come down to Budd and it's come down to McCrory. And I've had former Governor McCrory on my show here a couple times. We have not been able to get Ted Budd on the show. Mark Walker has also come on and talked about his campaign. But you know, John, it feels like here in the 11th hour, things got really, really nasty between these candidates. What have been your thoughts about this Republican primary?
It did get rough and tumble in the last few weeks of the campaign. If you've been following North Carolina politics for any length of time, this would not shock you. We've had rough and tumble Republican primaries for statewide offices like U.S. Senate a number of times in the past. For example, in 1986, when Jim Broyhill had been appointed to fill the seat of John East, and there was a Republican challenger, David Funderburk, and that was a rough race. In 1986, this is not a precedent that Republicans today want to think about too much, but in 1986, the rough and tumble primary, which Jim Broyhill did win, weakened him for the fall campaign, and he lost the fall campaign to Terry Sanford. Now, I don't know that if Ted Budd is the nominee, which is the most likely outcome according to the polls right now, I don't know that if he's the nominee, he faces a big chance of losing to the Democratic nominee Beasley, but it certainly weakens whoever the ultimate nominee is when a primary gets nasty. Sometimes people say primaries themselves are bad for the eventual nominee. I don't agree with that at all. Primaries are often good for candidates. They kind of strengthen them, like exercising their political muscles. They provide an opportunity to introduce somebody. In this case, Ted Budd had never run statewide, so the primary allowed him to be introduced through millions of dollars in advertising to voters, which will come in handy if he's the nominee. So I think primaries per se aren't bad at all. They're good. But in this case, the nastiness of particularly the advertising run by independent committees related to the two candidates has been a real problem. And I wrote about one of the sets of ads because it involved an organization, the John Locke Foundation, with which I've been intimately involved for more than three decades, because the Club for Growth, which supports Ted Budd and his race, had claimed the Locke Foundation as a source for an assertion that really wasn't true. So that kind of thing happens. We all know that because we've all followed politics or been involved in politics in the past. That doesn't mean it isn't something we ought to condemn. We ought to, and we ought to recognize that it does not do the Republic, or in this case, the party in question, the Republican Party, very much good for a primary to devolve into this kind of stuff.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I really took issue with is, you know, I study politics. I love politics. I watched carefully, you know, obviously when the General Assembly was taken over by Republicans, a lot of the measures and policies we were able to get passed. I thought McCrory, when he was a governor, was a pretty good governor. I actually think a lot of these large economic development announcements that we've heard most recently this year, especially in the central part of the state where I'm at, where you've got Boom coming and VinFast and Toyota and all these things that are starting to happen. I feel like a lot of this was rooted in the McCrory administration. So I personally sort of take an issue with some of these attacks that they've come after Governor McCrory with. Certainly I can understand people not wanting him to be the candidate, or you may not agree with them and those kind of things, but it almost seems like some of these attacks have just been outright lies.
They have been. The one that I wrote about that involved the Locke Foundation had to do with the North Carolina Textbook Commission. This is an entity that is really an advisory board. It doesn't actually pick the textbooks that all the schools in the state use, but it does make a list of recommended textbooks. And back several years ago, in the middle of the McCrory administration, he appointed a number of Democrats. There are 22 members of the commission. 11 of the people he appointed were registered Democrats. That is because the governor, according to statute, can only appoint people recommended by the state superintendent of public instruction. Back in 2014, when this occurred, that person was June Atkinson, a Democrat. So naturally, she was recommending lots of Democrats and probably a few other people. And McCrory was having to decide whether to staff the commission at all or to pick at least some of the people that she recommended. So it's, you know, you could debate whether McCrory should have just taken no nominations at all and just left the commission without members or something like that. But he certainly didn't go out and choose Democrats over Republicans actively. And what was even more problematic about the Club for Growth ad is that it didn't say McCrory appointed Democrats to the Textbook Commission, which is absolutely true. That is, you could debate whether he should have or what the context is. That would have been a true statement. And that is what the John Locke Foundation blog post said that was being used as the source. What the people that made the advertisement decided to say was that Pat McCrory put liberals in charge of the state's textbooks, which is not true, which didn't have any evidence for it. Here in North Carolina, of course, you can't assume that every Democrat that might serve on a commission is a liberal. You can't assume that the textbook commission is in charge of textbooks, because it really isn't. Local school districts make their own decisions about which books they use. Even sometimes individual teachers make decisions about which books they use. So it was at least a highly exaggerated statement that was not supported by the source, which was the John Locke Foundation. And so I wrote about it and I said, look, this shouldn't have been in the ad. They should take it out of the ad. And because Mark Robinson, our current lieutenant governor, was the spokesman in the ad endorsing Budd over McCrory and making this statement, McCrory put liberals in charge of state textbooks, I thought it would have been appropriate for Robinson to insist that this claim be changed. I know he didn't come up with it. Obviously, that was written by the Club for Growth, and he simply spoke it, and he had no reason to know otherwise. This is the kind of thing that turns people off, that in this case describes former Governor McCrory's record entirely misleadingly. The news media did evaluate this ad and claimed it mostly, or a related ad, and claimed it mostly false. And it's not the only example. I mean, there are lots of examples in this race and in others where people can't seem to stick to the basic facts. They could have said Pat McCrory appointed Democrats to the State Textbook Commission. He should have fought harder to appoint a majority of Republicans or something like that. And Algernon, that would have been factually correct. You know, the rest of it's an opinion, which is fine. People get to have opinions. But instead of sticking to the facts, they exaggerated, they misled, and they put the Locke Foundation's name on it. That's why I wrote the column that I did. But I don't want to just say that it's about this one ad. It's not. The race has had a lot of different charges and countercharges that have been problematic. And I think that the race has actually been impoverished by a lack of substance. People actually, particularly Budd and McCrory, really engaging on the substance of policy. How are they differ if they were in the Senate, who would vote for what? Would they all be, would they vote pretty much the same? Would they be different? I don't know. Do you know?
I don't know.
Come up.
And I've been watching this every day.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to know. Now, you know, some of this, a lot of this has to hang on Bud and the Bud campaign because they refused to let him debate. There were a number of debates, some of them televised statewide, that McCrory attended and Mark Walker attended. Another candidate, Marjorie Eastman, attended. And Bud just skipped them all. And if he had been there, he would have been asked these questions, and there may have been more interesting substantive clash between the two front runners, Bud and McCrory. That would have been good for them. It would have been good for Republican primary voters. It would have been good for North Carolinians in general. And it didn't happen. While I think that that's probably the sort of original sin of this is Bud's unwillingness to debate, I don't think it's entirely Bud's fault. In general, the media, the other candidates, was there enough focus on the big issues that face our country, inflation, the budget deficits, the war in Ukraine, the cultural struggles that are happening right now in media and education, what's happening on our college campuses? These are substantive issues that U.S. senators may very well be voting about. And I don't have a clear sense. If Bud is the nominee, let's go with the polls for a second. If Ted Budd is the nominee, and if he defeats Sherry Beasley and he becomes U.S. senator next year, I really have very little idea what kind of senator he will be. And I think that's unfortunate.
You know, I want to unpack a little bit of what you've said here and to go back to some of the comments that have been made about former Governor McCrory. You know, I had Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson on the show last week, and he actually was still repeating some of the claims that you just mentioned and was talking about how weak McCrory was on education. Now, we all believe it's not been made official, but we believe that Mark Robinson is running for governor in 2024, and we'll be asking for the Republican nomination to do so. How problematic is it for a sitting Republican lieutenant governor to just be talking negatively about the former Republican governor? And keeping in mind, that was the first Republican to even be governor in many decades.
Yeah. Well, I don't mind people who are in positions of public life, whether they're elected to office or formerly elected to office or trying to get elected to office, having good faith disagreements with other people. If Robinson is saying McCrory should have done education different or some other issue different, I don't have any problem with that. You certainly shouldn't insist that people never speak ill of someone else in their party on a substantive matter, because parties encompass people who have different views or at least different approaches to their jobs, and we ought to air that. What would trouble me is Robinson restating this thing about McCrory being, you know, putting liberals in charge of state textbooks, which is just a silly claim that didn't happen. You could debate McCrory's education priorities. At the time when he was governor, I wrote about them, and I liked some of them, and I disliked some of them, and I said so. There's nothing wrong with that. But it would be difficult to construe Pat McCrory during his tenure as governor as anything other than a conservative on education. I mean, school choice dramatically expanded when he was governor, and he supported that. Or a number of other changes in education policy that he supported. I assume that if Mark Robinson was elected, based on what he has said so far, hasn't done a whole lot yet. He's lieutenant governor, which means he is on the State Board of Education and gets to do some policymaking in education. But I assume that if he's elected governor in 2024, he'd be a conservative governor on education. Find me an issue, for example, where McCrory and Robinson would truly disagree on education. And I would be very interested in hearing about that. I just don't know what it is. Surely it is not Robinson. If he had a Democratic state superintendent of public instruction and Robinson as a Republican was governor, then he would refuse to appoint anybody to the textbook commission because the nominations had become from a Democrat. I mean, if that's the difference, it's not a very important difference. I'll just have to tell you.
Yeah. You know, I want to also jump back to the point you made about Ted Budd. And I've shared with my audience, I mean, Congressman Budd is a personal friend of mine. I've known him for many, many years. I think he's a really good guy. But I have disagreed with his campaign strategy. And I totally understand, you know, he's got some high powered consultants around him. And I understand that this is the direction that they may be telling him to go in. But I just completely disagree. I love politics. I love the process. And I think it feels like to me this violates the process. Let's assume that Budd does get the nomination from Republicans, goes on to face Beasley in the general. How can Republicans even be confident, John, that Budd can even debate Beasley? I watched the Carolina Journal debate that was hosted by the Locke Foundation. Obviously, that was one of five debates that Budd decided not to show up in. I mean, if you can't show up and show how and defend how convicted you are in your beliefs and your ideas, if you can't do that against people in your own party, how can people in the party expect that you can do it against someone in the opposite party?
I think that's a valid question. Sometimes when people are front runners in the polls, they often get told by consultants, well, don't debate. Because the only thing that can happen is you will say something you didn't mean to. You will mangle something. It'll be a bad moment. It'll hurt you. It's better to just sort of coast to victory. I understand that strategy in a sort of theoretical way. I don't think in practical terms it's true. I think generally speaking, you're better off debating and getting better at it as you go. And also, you're going to have a general election, and are you going to really, if Budd is the nominee, is he really going to dodge a debate with the Democrat? That would be truly unwise and dangerous. And if he isn't going to dodge, then why not practice, yeah. Which is what happens during primaries. I think Ted Budd may be the only major Senate candidate in America this year who didn't agree to debate in the primary. I think I'm right about that. I'm also trying to think of a senator in North Carolina's past who refused to debate. Now, Jesse Helms didn't accept all the debate invitations that were extended to him, but he did debate. I remember I watched his debate with Jim Hunt in 1984, and it was fascinating. And he was actually a pretty good debater. All the others, Richard Burr has debated in all of his races, as far as I can recall. And in particular, his debate performance against Erskine Bowles was one of the things that put him over the top. People underestimated Richard Burr. He showed that he was really quite comfortable and persuasive in a debate setting. Erskine Bowles kind of admitted later that, well, I guess he beat me in the debate. So I think it's a mistake for people who are going to be a U.S. senator from a major state like North Carolina to dodge debate invitations. Now, if there had been 12 or even 8, and the Budd campaign says, oh, we're not going to do 8 debates. We're going to do 3 debates or something. I can understand that. I absolutely can. But not to debate at all, I think, is a mistake. 2022 is likely to be a red-leaning year, and it may very well be that Ted Budd will be okay, even though he didn't debate and doesn't have a lot of practice and maybe even dodges a debate with Beasley. Maybe he'll turn out okay, but why make that kind of bet? I would venture to assume that Ted Budd is reasonably okay at debating. He's a current member of Congress. He had to speak a lot when he was running for office the first time. I'm sure that he could have handled himself fine. And let me just say, although we've been critiquing and disagreeing with the Budd campaign strategy here, let me say something positive about it. Budd did something that I really wish most statewide candidates would do, which is that he did spend time, I think, in every county. I think he actually traveled to every county or almost every county meeting with voters. I think that's a great thing. I think candidates should do that. I think that will serve him well. I think that's a good dedication to the state as a whole. But it is not an excuse for dodging debates. So if they said, well, you know, we didn't want to debate in some TV studio, we could be out campaigning, you can do both. And they should have done both.
Let's, you know, assuming that he does win, I mean, that's the direction all the polls are indicating. And we've talked about the fact he didn't debate. I agree with you. I love the fact that he got out and crisscrossed the state. He's very charismatic. I think he does very well on the stump. He's very well spoken and articulate. He knows how to, be persuasive with his ideas, which is why I'm just sort of wondering or curious why he didn't debate. Let's say he does win. What does that then say about the Republican base? Because obviously he got the Trump nomination. He got about $14 million from Club for Growth and outside money. I mean, does that just say that, hey, you know, as long as you get the Trump endorsement, you got a bunch of money behind you, you don't necessarily have to defend your ideas? I mean, is that where we're going as a party now? Or?
Well, it made Ted Budd look like a bit of an empty suit. And I know that that's, I'm sure he resents, he would resent me saying that. I'm sure that he would resent other people thinking he's an empty suit, but that's what it, that's what these decisions made him look like, that he wasn't willing to engage on the issues in a high stakes environment like a debate, that instead he was going to let endorsements from somebody else and ads run by an out of state PAC put him over the top. And it makes him look like he's sort of not ready for primetime. I think that may very well be unfair, but those are the choices that he made. His campaign would say, huh, what do Algernon and Hood know? I mean, we
nominated
our candidate, but I'm just here to tell you, he, if and when he becomes a U.S. Senator, if he gets the nomination and defeats Beasley in the fall, he is going to have to prove himself. And he would have already proved himself this year if he had done what we're talking about. But now he's going to have to prove himself. Maybe he will. I hope he will. But I just think that it's unnecessary. Now, I would also tell you that this is not the first time that a candidate who may have had other preferences or inclinations has instead listened to a political consultant. And to, if that's the scenario, which I suspect it is, then I would say to Bud, if he's the U.S. Senator, you, be the boss. If and when you run again or run an, do any other kind of political activity and your consultant says, well, it's too risky, we don't want you to get out in front of a camera, tell them no. Because you are going to be a, if Bud is successful, he's going to be a, in an elite club of 100 people in America who serve in the upper chamber of the Congress. And it is his responsibility, not just to North Carolina, but to the nation, to be a leader. And a leader doesn't get led around by the nose by some political actor who doesn't have the responsibility that the senator has. So I'm just saying, if this is the scenario and he has kind of swallowed his, what he would otherwise have loved to do a debate, but he had to listen to his consultants, don't let it happen again, because you need to be the boss.
I think that's great advice. You know, I went out and I voted early, and I was talking to the poll watchers and poll observers, and they said it hadn't been too busy, not a lot of energy at the polls, at least for early voting. I guess we'll see what the primary day looks like. And, you know, I was surprised to hear that because, you know, on the Democratic side, I do expect them to be, you know, less enthused right now because they don't have a big top of the ticket.
Turnout is quite low for Democratic primary voters.
And I would expect this, but I would also expect turnout to be high for Republicans right now because of everything we just talked about on the show. However, I'm starting to look down the road at the general election. We don't know exactly what's going to happen with this Roe v. Wade debate, but people are hypothesizing that come June or so, we could see a majority opinion that would overturn Roe v. Wade. You've been around this a long time. I mean, how does that impact the November election? And certainly, how does that impact enthusiasm for Democrats?
I think that if Roe is overturned, it gives the Democrats something to mobilize the base around. Keep in mind that it will also give Republicans something to mobilize its social conservative base around. The politics of abortion been poorly understood by many actors for a very long time. You know, you take a simple poll. Do you think Roe versus Wade should be overturned? Most Americans say no. It doesn't mean they necessarily think Roe v. Wade was wrong, was correctly decided, or that they support the current abortion laws in the United States. They just may not want to hear about abortion for weeks or months or years to come, which is not an irrational concern. But if you poll people more in a more sophisticated way about abortion, you find out that that views run the gamut, and there are lots of different kinds of positions. I remember when I was in college, I worked for one of the very first media pollsters in the country, just a leading opinion research expert. And I really loved him. I worked for him actually for a while when I was in school. But he said something about abortion that is absolutely wrong. He said, abortion is one thing where there just isn't much of a middle. There's either people who are this or people who are that. And he couldn't have been more wrong. Most Americans are somewhere in the middle on this issue. In other words, they don't think late-term abortions should be legal. They consider it basically be butchering a baby. So they should be legal only in cases where the life of the mother is in danger. And most Americans also do not favor banning abortion at the moment of conception. So if that's your position, abortion should be illegal from the moment of conception, or abortion should be illegal all the way to the moment of birth, then you are entitled to your opinion, but your opinion is not shared by very many other people. Most Americans are somewhere in the middle. Hmm. In my view, that argues for letting state legislatures and governors figure out what the policy should be in various states. And some states will be more permissive of abortion, and some states will be more restrictive of abortion. And that will reflect elected lawmakers struggling with these conflicting views and trying to come up with a position that meets the test of, you know, sort of the rough majority view. And that means that Roe has to go, because Roe doesn't allow any of that kind of political bargaining. So that's the argument for letting Roe go that is not the same as we're going to ban all abortions, or we're not going to ban all abortion, but the level at which the conversation occurs is the wrong place. It's not, you don't settle these very complicated issues involving a multiplicity of different viewpoints in the public through a judicial process. You do it through a legislative process. So that's the argument. The politics of it are that for many Democrats who are otherwise dispirited, this may very well juice them. And I think, Algernon, you have made this point before, that this may very well give Democrats something to organize around. Of course, pro-life Republicans and Democrats will also be energized by this. I think the net effect is probably either a wash or maybe a slight boost to the Democrats, simply because Republicans were already motivated, already more highly motivated. But in my view, and you may disagree with me, I don't think this is going to rise to the top of the agenda list. Most voters are going to vote on inflation. They're going to vote on a sort of a general concern about the future of the economy. They're going to vote on American strength, whether they think America's strong enough, which has implications for China or Ukraine or immigration or lots of other things that have to do with American might and power and resolve. And I think to some extent it will be an election still about, like it was last year during the municipal races, about education, about the aftermath of COVID, the way we need to get children back into learning, the significant learning loss, concerns about what kids are learning in school. I think those issues are probably going to outweigh abortion for most voters who haven't already made up their minds.
Yeah, I think those issues are going to obviously be very important. I just think when you get in purple states or purple districts like a North Carolina, you take an issue like Roe v. Wade and the overturning of Roe v. Wade, where, you know, in North Carolina, Trump only won the state by one percentage point. Then all of a sudden, if Democrats are effective with their messaging, I think you could see some real interest and energy come November at the polls. And then you combine that with the fact that you've got the potential to elect the first Black woman from North Carolina to the Senate. You combine it with the Roe v. Wade issue, then all of a sudden it just feels like to me North Carolina Democrats are going to have a tremendous amount of energy going into November.
I mean, they could. It certainly gives them some opportunities that otherwise probably didn't have. It's just a question of whether they'll be able to capitalize on them this year. I don't know, but
and whether they can get the messaging right. I saw over the weekend that President Biden is already starting to adjust his midterm election messaging and using this phrase MAGA voters to try to sort of carve them out from the from the ordinary Republican Party. So
yes, they know well that they're going to win or lose some of these key congressional and legislative races in the suburbs. And they're going to go to a suburban voter and say, you know, you might have voted for Obama and then maybe Trump in 2016 and then maybe Biden in 2020. And I know you want something like normalcy. And I don't think you're not satisfied. But if you vote for the Republicans, you'll get even more crazy. I mean, that's the message they want to deliver to those voters. And can they do it on Roe versus Wade? I don't know. But that's certainly
what I think is interesting. What I saw over the weekend is that they're actually trying to talk to Republican voters, but now they're trying to carve the MAGA voters out from the ordinary Republican voters, which I think also just points to the schism that's happening within the Republican Party right now.
This is the idea. In North Carolina, this division may matter to Democrats. It will very much matter in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania, where the Democrats have already figured out what they want to do is they want to go after Republicans who are disaffected with, for example, J.D. Vance as the Senate nominee in Ohio with 32% of the vote. Maybe this candidate in the state senator in Pennsylvania that Trump endorsed, maybe he will win the Pennsylvania Senate primary. Maybe another sort of Trump-affiliated or Trump-oriented Republican will win the gubernatorial nomination in Pennsylvania. And that then Democrats will go after other kinds of Republicans to say, is this really what you stand for? You're absolutely right. That's the play they've got. I think there are places where that play will succeed. I'm just not sure yet whether one of those places is North Carolina.
Yeah. Well, we're finding out soon. So we've got a primary coming up soon. We will know at least who the Republican nominee is for the United States Senate. Then, of course, the final decision will be made by voters in November. Excuse me. I can't speak today. But I do want to remind my audience that despite what you're hearing about all of this top of the ticket races, there's a lot of important bottom of the ticket races that are happening that you also need to be paying attention to. You've got city council races over in Greensboro. You've got school board races over in Forsyth County. And so just as much energy and attention and time that we put on to these top of ticket races, you also want to pay attention to the bottom of the ballot because those elected leaders can really impact your day-to-day life. John, I really appreciate you locking in with me. This is always fun. To my audience, we will have Mitch Coca from the John Locke Foundation. He will be on next week to do some political analysis as we sort of look back and look at what happened with primary day that's coming up. John, before I let you go, you got anything you'd like to share with the audience?
Well, as you know, I'm still writing historical fantasy novels. So my first novel, Mountain Folk, about the Revolutionary War, came out last year. My new book is called Forest Folk, and it's about the War of 1812, the Trail of Tears, and the abolitionist movement, the beginnings of the abolitionist movement, including a scene that's set on the Guilford College campus at the Underground Railroad tree. So people may enjoy that story, which I enjoyed learning about.
Throw out the website real quick so they know where to go find the book and
pick it up. You can find all my books at folklorecycle.com. Folklorecycle.com. That's the name of the series, Mountain Folk, followed by Forest Folk.
Yeah, and in addition to the books, you can always catch John's commentary. If you can grab a local paper, a lot of times you'll see some op-eds and commentary from John Hood in that paper. I try to read everything I can get my hands on from John. Very smart guy, a lot of great insight, wonderful historian. John, appreciate you being here. To my audience, also, if you want to learn more about, like I mentioned earlier, we had Governor McCrory on the show twice. Mark Walker's been on. We had Mark Robinson on last week. You can go check out the podcast. Go to Apple, Spotify, Pandora, wherever you like to get your favorite podcast, you can lock in with me there. Make sure you also are following Algernon Cash on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, y'all stay locked in.
The executive producer of the Locked In podcast is Algernon Cash for WCG. The associate producer is Tim Beeman for Such and Such Media. The views and opinions in this podcast are solely those of the contributors and are not necessarily those of our distributors or hosting company. This podcast is copyrighted and cannot be reproduced without express written consent of WGC.